Election night TV coverage used all sorts of high and low-tech gimmickry to communicate results to viewers. The top of the Empire State Building was lit with climbing red and blue bars as states were called for each candidate. A map of the United States laid onto the ice rink at Rockefeller Center was spray-painted blue and red as the night progressed. And there were the slick, luminous electoral maps activated by the touch of an anchor's hand, like a giant, all-knowing iPhone. No holograms, though. And as The Daily Show noticed, there was also a preoccupation with social media.
John, I am loaded for bear tonight with real-time Election Center media analysis capabilities, live monitoring results and opinions as they happen through a light-speed stream of instantaneous real-time microblogging.
That's what I'm doing today. The layman out there, if I can't, you're checking Twitter.
Whoa, that is just the appetizer, John, and let me demonstrate. This is an actual real-time tweet. Uh-huh. He says, I personally voted for Mitt Romney. So if that single tweet is any indication, John, get used to saying President Romney because he's going to win tonight in a landslide.
Ira Chinoy, associate dean of the University of Maryland's College of Journalism, has studied election nights past and present, and he says the use of technology has a long tradition.
Around the time of the Civil War, telegraph was starting to be used to bring returns in, and it was important for newspapers to reach the crowds that were gathered on the streets. And as the crowds got larger, they couldn't simply announce the returns or post them on paper and reach enough people. So they started using something called a magic lantern, which would be a little bit like an overhead projector today.
Like a Batman image against the clouds?
Yes. It was basically a block of calcium that shone really bright, and they'd run it through some lenses and put some transparencies in front of it and shine it on the side of the building. A little later in the 19th century, one of the innovations was to put a very large searchlight on the top of newspaper buildings. Newspapers would publish ahead of time codes that would say, you know, if the light shines west, so-and-so is winning. If the light shines east, so-and-so is winning.
So tell me about that paper in Minnesota during the McKinley campaign and election.
Right. So all of this is sort of broadcasting before broadcasting. It's ways of spreading news to people far and wide before we had radio or TV. So the newspaper in St. Paul borrowed the whistle, the ship's whistle, from a great steamship, had it trucked to St. Paul and put it on the top of a building. They published the codes ahead of time, and they were a pro-McKinley paper, so if McKinley won, it was going to be some sharp toots, and if Bryant won, it was going to be a low wailing moan from the whistle.
We take broadcast coverage of elections for granted now, but at one time, this stuff seemed too ephemeral to actually have validity, right?
Right. In fact, in 1916, Lee DeForest, who was an inventor of some early radio equipment, went on the air on election night to launch effectively a wireless newspaper. The headlines called it an air paper and a scheme to use the atmosphere as a medium for sending news. And he later boasted that it was going to mark a significant epoch in the distribution of news. But even as commercial radio appeared in 1920, there were people who didn't really think that radio was a proper medium for news. It was too ephemeral. You couldn't hold it in your hands. You couldn't reread it. You couldn't go back and study it.
Jumping ahead to 1952, the first presidential election predicting computer, the UNIVAC.
There were two computers, in fact, used that night. The UNIVAC was used by CBS, and a much smaller computer called the Monrobot was used by NBC. It was in a lot of ways an era much like our own. There were brand new competing technologies. The computer industry was brand new. It sort of, I think, felt like the dot-com boom. Everyone was jumping in and trying to invent a computer. And, we tend to think that a technology like computers came along, and of course it would just be obvious to everybody that that's what should be used. But there was not a common agreement that this was a great thing. And NBC backed away in 1954 and said that, it was going to use human beings on election night in 1954. The best experts were going to be better than any statistical device.
Which is maybe why we saw no holograms on CNN
right.
The other night. Now with more humanity.
Right. I give them a little credit, though, on CNN with the hologram in 2008. A lot of people ribbed them.
Because it was pointless and provided no insight whatsoever into what was actually going on.
Right. So if you were to read the newspaper reviews of election night 1952, that's precisely what people would say about the use of computers on that night. The day could come when the hologram becomes a kind of an interesting tool to use in bringing news to people. We just don't know. I'm more inclined to be less dismissive of it than I was when I first saw it.
Did people make fun of the UNIVAC the way they made fun of those holograms?
Yeah, absolutely. Several of the leading sort of entertainers and comedians of the day certainly poked some fun at, Arthur Godfrey poked some fun at the UNIVAC and then later came back and apologized. And Ernie Kovacs, was a broadcasting comedian of the day, and he created a little thing he called the Koviac. I think in one segment he fed it some beer and, people had a lot of fun with it.
Ira, thank you very much.
You're more than welcome.
Ira Chinoy is the Associate Dean of Journalism at the University of Maryland's College of Journalism.
Yes, it's Spencer Tracy, as you've never seen him before, and Katharine Hepburn, as you've always wanted to see her. They'll have you rocking and rolling with laughter as they match wits with Miss Emmy, the machine that can replace everybody except a woman like Katie. Wow. You ain't seen nothing till you've seen what goes on and on and on with the desk set.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Doug Anderson, with more help from Lita Martinez and Ariel Stuhlberg. And it was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Ken Feldman.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts and read our blog at onthemedia.org. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And I urge you to do that. We have a great Twitter feed. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.